your mama sad type. Make your girlfriend mad type. Might seduce your dad type.
You bad guy?
Duh.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Stone Cold Shots, professional wrestling podcast where the shots are cold, the takes are hot. Every episode, every week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, whatever we, however many damn weeks we feel like, we come through to you, bringing you the best in recaps, ratings, reviews, professional wrestling, papes, or a pay-per-view if you're a square. I'm no longer going pay-per-view or pape if you're nasty. It's pape from now on. Unless you're a fucking loser, then you say pay-per-view. That's when you say the whole word. I'm right. Changing the game out here. I'm putting that into the universe.
Okay.
All right, man. We got you. Don't worry about it.
We're doing a very special, very heartfelt memorial episode today. Why don't you guys just kick it off? Give me your best ayo and tell the people at home who you are.
Ayo. Are you guys here today to see the heel host Camp Faulkner? Boo!
Boo!
Are you guys here to see JFP?
Woo! Yay!
Woo!
Survey says, one more for the good guys. I'm Josh Felix, prior to the internet, darling.
Hey, yo. My name is Lauren. The regular darling. I just want what's coming to me. I just want what I deserve.
You did a little Razor Ramon into Charlie Brown Christmas.
Yeah.
I loved it.
Hey, you could tell Santa Claus to make it out in 10s and 20s.
You can tell Santa Claus that he can come to my shitty little one ornament tree. A real streets tree.
Hey, yo. You know what they say? Heel times don't last. But heel hosts do.
Yes!
This is Nobody's Darling. Campbell Falconer. Of course, we are talking about the career, the illustrious career of Scott Hall, Razor Ramon, today. This sucks. I hate doing these episodes. I'm sick of doing these. The retrospective episodes, but it's
I'm getting verklempt over here about it.
Yeah, it's it's, you know, it's great to take an opportunity to go back and look, especially someone like Scott Hall, who Lauren, you and I feel like coming in a little bit more recently to wrestling, like weren't around for like the heyday of the NWO or sort of like pretty much all of the stuff that we're talking about today. So it's really nice, like things where it's like, oh, you know, like I have a understanding of the historical significance of this dude, but like I've probably watched before, like we sat down for this, I'd probably watch like 3 Scott Hall matches.
Yeah, I would say my only exposure to him would be through our podcast. So if you want to do a deep dive into our archives of episodes, you can tell me how many episodes I've, like, how many matches of his I've actually seen. I've always known him to be very charismatic and very cool, but I don't think I knew much more about him beyond that. So this was a good time.
Josh, you've been along for the whole ride, your whole life, a mark from day one. You got some Razor stories. What did the bad guy mean to you?
Yeah, born a mark, I'll die a mark, you know? So, yeah, like, you know, I remember, you know, Razor, when he first came out, I remember the vignettes, watching them live with my brother. And, yeah, we'd watch, and, you know, we saw him coming in, and we saw his debut, and it just immediately struck how cool, he's like the coolest wrestler in history. I don't even think it's close. I don't even think there's a close second place, you know? But, yeah, Scott Hall, for me, was always like the bar of being cool and oozing machismo. So yeah, this is a tough one. Like, you know, and it's a little sad that, you know, it seemed like he got his stuff together for a while there with DDP and seemed like he was bouncing back after being in a really bad spot. And, you know, it's kind of sad that it turned out like this, but he definitely had a great career and an impactful career for sure on me and I'm sure a bunch of people.
Oh yeah. Were you like, is this a thing where it's like, did people, you know, because nowadays, like I only have like a current sort of like wrestling climate to compare this to, and people will talk about like, you know, Pac in AEW versus Neville in WWE. Was there like in all the Monday Night Wars, like sort of jumping back and forth, was there sort of like a, you know, did you have a preference for Scott Hall or did you have a preference for Razor Ramon? Is there, did that kind of thing, you know, like how did that kind of thing work out back then?
It's a little tricky. So like the Scott Hall character has only really changed in the fact that he dropped the heavy Cuban accent, right? Or whatever.
Which like, we'll get to it later, but like even there's like a couple of things where it's like he's still throwing out like mangs, you know?
Yeah,
like,
mang. Yeah. So I think he dropped the mang, but Scott Hall was pretty consistent. And I mean, like, well, you know, Razor will always have a soft spot in my heart. You know, his Scott Hall run was so iconic and the jump and, you know, everything like that. It's like, you know, which one of your kids do you love more? It's the same guy just doing two differently cool things, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right on. Should we jump in? I mean, like, it is like that legacy of him being really cool. I think my favorite thing that I've seen eulogizing him so far from somebody that isn't like Kevin Nash was somebody that I'm friends with on Facebook. This chick just said, RIP Scott Hall, you were like the third hottest dude of all time.
Like, that's actually very good.
Yeah, it fucking rocks, you know.
Yeah.
So we kind of did, this is maybe not as complete of a career retrospective as we have done for certain other people, like when we did Brody Lee or when we did like Keiji Muto. This is like pretty contained to about like a decade, right? Like it's like we kind of start in 92, we finish in 2001. So we're missing like a little bit of the NWA stuff. And then we're not really doing too much from like when he came back to WWF. I think mostly because like the standout match from that last WWF run was like really the Stone Cold match at WrestleMania 18. And we're undoubtedly going to cover WrestleMania 18 sometime. So I didn't want to double down on that too much.
Stay tuned.
Yeah, stay tuned. This makes sense. It's a good potpourri kind of assortment of just different matches. And, you know, and his, again, like his latest, like I guess his NWO run in the WWE, you know, there wasn't too many highlights, to be honest. And, you know,
we could have done, there was a very highly recommended match of him and Kevin Nash against Team 3D in TNA. Okay. That we could have done that would have been interesting, but
I will say when I was like researching matches and stuff, a huge run that or like feud that people seem to be really into was Razor Ramon versus the Heartbreak Kid Shawn Michaels. Well, there always in his top 10 matches, there were at least two of them were with him, and so I was like, oh, okay.
We already did the Heartbreak Kid ladder match when we did WrestleMania 10. Okay. So that was why
I have no memory of that, but I believe you.
That's why we haven't covered this here. The thing that stood out to me of like all of his like big sort of matches when we were going through looking stuff up was like how much of it was tags. It was like the sort of like must watch matches. I feel like at least half of them were tags with Scott Hall, six man tags with Hulk Hogan or Six, like X-Pac. And it really does contribute to that kind of legacy of this dude being like the greatest, one of the greatest of all time to never hold the top championship, right? Like he was a perennial tag guy, an intercontinental guy, and like still kind of cemented his legacy as one of the greatest of all time without ever, you know, holding the world championship in anywhere that he went, right? Which is super, super interesting.
Yeah, and I think, you know, kind of like the only other stuff that we can you know, that we could have really touched on was the SummerSlam match with Michaels. But I think we did a good point in kind of like picking up different kind of like, you know, if you were a fan at the time, you would have watched these matches and probably got a good grasp of his wrestling style. So it's like, you know, the first match we were going to do with the 1-2-3 kid was iconic, you know, for other reasons, because it was a platform to kind of launch off. Not necessarily like a super stellar match, we can get into it, but like it's different kind of points kind of turning in his career, right? So I don't know. I like the list. It's kind of through WWF and WCW. So yeah.
Yeah.
He seems like somebody who is like incredibly reliable and incredibly good, like very compelling heel. But I think generally you need incredibly compelling heels to launch incredibly compelling baby faces. So like maybe that's part of why he never broke through to be like the number one guy, is because he was always playing an incredibly important role in elevating other talent. And not that that's not worth as much, but it's just, it's a different role.
So we start off, before we get into the 1-2-3 kid match, I wanted to start off with like the you were talking, you watched the vignettes with your brother, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the first ever, I love the idea of like, this is the first fucking thing that you ever see of this guy. If you're just, if you're not following the territories, you're not, you're like just watching WWF in 1992, and they cut to this vignette of this fucking giant dude walking down the streets in like a huge white suit.
He's and in about, like an alleyway with graffiti.
Yeah, like 1,000 gold chains, and he's got the slick back mullet with the one little curly cue. It's all, it's amazing how much it's all right there from this first little like minute and a half video package, or it's like just like a little promo kind of thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, oh, cool. So he didn't change his character at all after this for the rest of his career.
No, he was like, that's this him. Is just printing money. Like from here on out, it's like, this is the formula. Like, just go with this.
Yeah. So in the exact promo we're talking about, like, it's like a very slick and simple promo. He delivers it in his quintessential, like, very slow, deliberate way, and it's just very cool and confident, and you can't not love it.
And it's like, it conveys the character so well too, right? When he said, you referenced this earlier, but when he says, all I want is what I've got coming to me, the world, Chico. And it's like, cool, love it, I can't wait, you know. And it's like, like he does such a good job, even though he's doing this like insane accent, and it's just like a dude named Scott from like the Midwest. But like, it's a great video package, and it introduces the character so well. What was like? Did you, when you watched the vignette or like the vignettes and the videos in the 90s? Like, did this hit as hard? Were you like, you know, like blowing your stack to like see this guy debut or?
Oh, yeah, like, well, because he seemed like a boss, right? Like, he was, like, he came off, like, that larger-than-life, that superstar that, you know, WWF back in the 90s were so good at building. So, this guy was, like, huge personality. I'm like, oh, man, this guy's going to be a real problem for, I don't know, Macho Man or whoever it was at the time, right? Like, you think about him coming in, and it's like, you knew he was going to be a top guy or go after something big, right? When he came in. So WWF, and again, like I miss vignettes so much where it's like that they were so good at, they last like, you know, 2, 3, 4 weeks depending, but then they would debut just kind of like beating up a jobber on a Raw afterwards, and like, you know, the announce team would just be putting them over the entire time. It's like, look at his swagger. Look at the way he carries himself. Like, you know, and they just be like talking about like just kind of the different characteristics and, you know, the size of him, mm-hmm. you know, and he doesn't care. And look at the disrespect and, you know, building story too. So it's like by the time, you know, 2-3 weeks of that kind of squash smash kind of thing, and they got involved with somebody, you had the vignettes, plus you had the squash matches where the team were putting him over. And then you had the actual feud, so you're ready for it at the time. And again, that kind of like, I know it's not long-term storytelling, but that kind of like more drawn out patience with a character, I think is kind of lacking today. So
yeah, I mean, it seems like a great way to build a character and introduce that character's personality to the crowd before they even get involved with the other wrestlers.
I feel like in the modern context, because I do kind of want to have a quick little aside here about vignettes and about like these introductory videos, because I feel like it kind of falls into one of two categories. You have, because like when I hear like a coming soon thing, the only thing that I think of is like Emelina or like Veer, right?
Where
it's like these like those are the two main people that I can think of who have had, like, you know, I tuned into Raw this week for the first time and I don't know how long, and I saw one of these Veer videos, and
he is truly coming.
He is truly coming. April 4th. Mark the date. Set your watch. But like,
but for instance, if you had Veer do the exact Razor Ramon promos, like out of context with nothing, Veer would be cool as shit, man. Like 4 weeks of that and Veer debuts. Are you kidding me? I'd be like, I'm all on board with Veer right now.
But like, the vignette kind of seems a little hokey because it seems like a thing that's so stuck in the 90s. You do have your like, yeah, like Veer is a prime example of like every time they show one of these, he becomes more of a joke and less of a threat of a real character.
Yeah, I feel like the way at least that WWE does promos or does little vignettes or whatever, mm-hmm. now is they do it so in a way that's so aware or so nostalgic, it is hokey. And like, I think that's what they're really trying to capitalize on with NXT 2.0. All of their new wrestlers have these really weird, long, hokey promo segments or like vignettes that are like really fucking weird, though. Like, they make them seem like jokes. Like, I'm thinking specifically of the guy with the accent who's like, I'm an Italian stereotype.
Tony D'Angelo,
yeah,
right?
Tony, which is
like
D'Angelo.
Tony, like, when I watched this, I was like, oh, this is what they're trying to do for Tony D. And to his credit, Tony D'Angelo seems to be really over in NXT 2.0,
but
right
he's
now.
he's over as a joke, and like, you know, Razor Ramon, sure. is over as like the mystique and like this like, yeah. air about him, and it's just like he was like, look at this fucking
I'm
guy,
trying to think what
know?
else, because like they had, I'm pretty sure like the university guy had a couple of vignettes like this, Tiffany Stratton had a couple of vignettes like this, and it does seem like they are trying to do this in NXT 2.0. but I also think that like kind of part of the reason why you can't really do this anymore is because, so like, as a wrestling fan, you're expected to be a little bit more familiar with people's like prior work on the indies or in Japan, or if they're like, they don't do this in AEW, right?
Actually, what I'm thinking of right now is what they're doing with Miro, where Miro's somebody who isn't being featured in matches right now, but every now and then they'll have these weird fucking vignettes where he's what?
They rock.
Yeah, and they're really
the
cool
Miro
of
ones.
Him just on a white green screen background saying insane shit to just sell the fact that he's an insane person now,
yeah.
and very into God.
Man, a white green screen background. I want to have him on a red green screen background.
but like, you know,
hey, you know, I'm the Redeemer Miro, and keep your stick on the ice.
Okay.
Well, we always say that, like, you know, the WWE product is supposed to be catered towards a younger audience, right? Like, that's the mm-hmm. idea. That's their ethos, right? And so it's like the logic wouldn't add up there, because if it's a younger audience, they wouldn't necessarily know this person's coming from AEW or
sure.
the indies and stuff like that. So they have this, and like, look, they rename people and they rebrand people. They got Butch now on SmackDown. Was Pete Dunne. rest in peace, my boy. I hope it works out for you. But you know what I mean? Like, you could like rebrand Butch and like do like how they brought in Finlay almost, right? It's like, you know, I'm Butch, I'm from the streets, and I carry a shillelagh, or whatever, right? Like, whatever they're going to do for
oh my
Butch.
God.
I think they should have called him PD Blinders instead of Butch.
God. I did not know that they rebranded Pete Dunne. I didn't know this. Shit.
Yeah,
He's dressed like Small Ridge Holland.
That fucking sucks. He already is a person.
Yeah.
Okay.
But instead of like Gunther. Like building Butch up, right? It's like Butch coming soon, right? Or like a couple weeks of him explaining his story and, you know, whatever it is. You know, this kind of debut. Or they like drag it. Veer's been 6 months. 6 months yeah. they've been dragging out Veer.
I think he just broke a record for the longest time between first vignette and actual debut, right?
Insane. It's anyway, not to dwell on this, but the way they used to do these kind of introductions and stuff like that, I felt really helped build the star, right? And now what they're doing is they're kind of like bringing these people in. And again, like either the vignettes aren't hitting or like they bring them in too quick and or they're doing something too quick or, you know, there's no good storytelling kind of in WWE, which I have a problem with. AEW does a bit better of a job, but, you know, for me, there's some still to be desired.
So getting into the first match, we're jumping into 1993. We've got Razor Ramon versus the 1-2-3 Kid. This is, I mean, like, first thing that I notice here is that Razor is, like, I don't think of Scott Hall as, like, a huge guy, but he's massive. He's, like...
He is a huge fucking guy.
He's a fucking gigantic beast. And, again, like, back in the day when everybody was huge, right? Like, it's, mm-hmm. You kind of lose, and he's always with Kevin Nash as well, so you kind of, like...
I think that's the thing, right? Is that he, like, spent his entire career standing next to Diesel, who is, like, ungodly large. But, yeah. Like... He makes, X-Pac's not the biggest dude around, but like he fucking towers over X-Pac.
And X-Pac is still like 5'11", 6 foot, like maybe 6'1". Yeah. Like, I don't know. Like, I'm sure he's a tall dude.
Yeah.
Yes. Scott Hall, Razor Ramon is 6'7".
Yep.
Which is very large. And he has that body physique, which, you know, I was telling you about this, but he has that body physique where he's incredibly tall, but all of the proportions are like exactly as if he were a regular like 5'10" dude or like, so everything is like all his fat is and muscle is perfectly distributed across his body. So he just, it's such a fucking wild look because when you look at him, you're like, he's like a giant man. Like, he's just, if you took a regular man and just like sent him through the Willy Wonka machine to make him a bit bigger, like it's super strange.
Yeah, he was like kind of like that kind of like perfect like gladiator. He could have been in 300, like the way he's kind of built, right? Like, just anyway, I'm not gonna,
he's exactly like a video game man.
Exactly. It's also a video game man.
His ring gear rules, like the purple and gold with like the razors on it. Like,
like throughout all of these matches that we are going to cover, his ring gear is always one of the sickest looks on the stage. Like, he,
oh, he's on point.
Has fantastic looks, and it's because they're all very simple but very effective. And this one has like the little razor blades on his butt, and they're great.
So this is a real short and sweet match. This is like, I gather that the story behind this is that X-Pac has been going by a number of different names, always being the something Kid. And he's been kind of like, commentary says, what's he called this week?
I think you're, that's
like,
a little later.
Oh, is that?
That's fucked up.
I can give you a little history on this. So he came in, okay, and he's doing jobs. He was like the Lightning Kid, and he was something else Kid, like, so it was changing, and I think on the indies he was something else, but like this week he was the Lightning Kid. And then so going into this, like, they didn't really do too much building to this, and you'd only see him getting swashed by people. So this is I think my first memory of like kind of a job guy since Barry Horowitz getting an upset victory at some point in his career, or the Brooklyn Brawler maybe getting an upset.
Who?
Brooklyn Brawler?
Okay.
One of the most famous job guys of all time.
Sorry.
We'll do a retrospective on him one day. But yeah, so like, this was wild. Like, it just was out of nowhere. No idea who this guy was. He wasn't featured in any way possible. And he's going to this match like another squash match for Razor, right?
Yeah. And Lightning Kid has a pretty good showing here, right? Like, I feel like he gets in a little bit of shit. Like, it's like, oh, he's quick. You know, he's fast. He's doing. And it's like a testament to X-Pac that he is. We talk about this a lot going back to watching like 90s matches, that there's a couple, 1-2-3 couple of guys who are like, oh, man, if you pluck them out of 1993 and put them into 2022, they would be right at home. They wouldn't miss a beat. It would fit right in. And he gets in a few good moves. Razor starts like beating his ass. The abdominal stretch where he picks the leg looks great, you know. It's just like, here's a guy who's got it all together, absolute powerhouse. He's like crushing this dude. And then his hubris kind of gets the better of him, and 1-2-3 Kid hits him with like a roll up pin, right? Like, and
no,
and
it's a backflip off the top. It's a moonsault off the top rope.
Oh, yeah. I'm thinking of, there's another match we're going to talk about.
Yeah, we'll talk about that one in a bit.
Beautiful, beautiful high flying. Yeah, like,
and the moonsault was great too. I don't know if you two saw this, but the way he lands the moonsault, his knee kind of hits Razor in the head, so it looks like there's a legitimacy to it that he could have like caught him and like kind of temporarily knocked him out. So it really kind of worked for the moment. And like, again, just a quick, you know, like surprise victory out of nowhere. And this was like the talk of the town for the next month. You know, I remember Lord Alfred Hayes having a segment on it in the next Superstars on Saturday and really doing a deep dive into it. So it was pretty fun.
I was watching a little bit of like they kind of like feuded for a little bit. There was like a follow up match with like if 1-2-3 Kid wins, he gets like a $10,000 from Razor Ramon, and Razor's throwing around a bunch of money in the ring, and it's like, it's cool to look at this guy who is like 6'7", hell of a promo, like got everything going for him. He's clearly like destined for greatness, still willing to like put over this like tiny little kid. Because it's like, oh, hey, here's a really fun story that we can tell. Here's a really interesting, cool feud that is going to get people hyped. It's not all about what's going to make me look better or what's better for me in the long run. It's like this as a performance, and this as like a storytelling. What's going to be engaging? What's going to be captivating?
Yeah, he's always super good at that. And like, look what it did for you know, Lightning Kid, 1-2-3 Kid, right? Launched his career, and you know, and especially at that time, you know, in the land of the giants and the WWF, I mean, somebody has kind of like, you know, weight and kind of stature, you know, wouldn't really have a chance then. But you know, Scott Hall put him over like $1 million and launched him.
How many bald heads you give this one? It's short and sweet. I can't imagine it gets a lot, but.
No, in honor of Razor, I'm doing toothpicks today. So this
toothpicks.
That's good.
This one I'm gonna give, because it was like, it was a crisp match. The match was only 3 minutes, so you know, I gave it 2¾, just because, you know, it was too short to be a match, but it was fine for what it was.
Nice.
That makes sense. Next we have Razor Ramon versus Rick Martel from.
Also, 1993.
October 1993?
Yeah. Okay. So it's like, we're jumping forward. And it, like, this is the other great thing, that it's like, we're jumping forward not even 6 months, and he's challenging for the vacant Intercontinental Championship, right?
Mm-hmm.
It like, again, shows that kind of thing where it's like, this is a match that it's like, I kind of, and Josh, I feel like you're going to blow up at me about this, but like, everyone who was complaining about Adam Cole taking a loss to Orange Cassidy, and saying like, oh, this is ridiculous, like, and it's like, this hurts Adam Cole's believability, and it's like, you know, Razor losing to 1-2-3 and having a like month-long feud with this like tiny dude doesn't hurt the believability of him going for the Intercontinental. Like, I really appreciate this storytelling, and I can see this sort of like reflected in the current wrestling landscape that I like seeing that.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, you know, like, I wasn't crazy about the Orange Cassidy, Adam Cole situation. It wasn't for me. Like, I don't think he should have lost that match. I've said it before. And but Orange Cassidy is an established character, right? Like, it wasn't like a surprise. Like, this shouldn't have happened. You know, grossly overestimating whatever. So it was again Razor's ego that got the better of him in that situation. Yeah. There's good storytelling there, right? So it didn't hurt him at all, because he got back and he, you know, beat the shit out of the 1-2-3 Kid. Then he got back on the horse and he kept going. And so, and this is great because, you know, I don't know if you two know about Rick Martel.
But no, my first note that I wrote down here is, who the fuck is Rick Martel?
One half of Strike Force with Tito Santana. one of the coolest handshakes ever. Turned on Tito Santana at one point and became the model Rick Martel, and he carried around this big bug spray bottle of perfume called Arrogance.
Amazing.
He blinded Jake the Snake Roberts with it. They had a bag over the head match at, I think it was WrestleMania. Don't quote me on this, 4 or 5. And so it was, it was a whole gimmick, but he was an awesome, awesome, awesome heel. Great wrestler. He actually had a great series of matches with Booker T and WCW that I wouldn't mind checking out sometime. Funny story, when Don Callis was coming into the WWF, he was supposed to be in a tag team with Rick Martel called the Supermodels. And they were supposed to, that was supposed to be it. But Rick Martel, one of the great, I would say, underrated, under-focused on workers of all time.
It's funny, I was trying, when we were watching this, I was like, I feel like we've seen this guy before. I feel like we've watched, maybe he was in, like, a Survivor Series match. And I realized that because of the blue tights and because they were talking about him being from Canada, I was thinking of Doug Furness.
Fair enough.
but we did watch Strikeforce in a Survivor Series match, so I was kind of right while still being completely and utterly wrong.
Yeah, you're just off by a few years.
Yeah. The other thing that I really want to shout out before we get into like actual match itself is I thought it was hilarious that this was a time when they had like bikini chicks holding up like signs in running around like boxing ish was very funny to me.
The Fink always added a great presence, like that like voice, like, you know, Fink again, like you see these people like Fink and Gene Okerlund who were so good at what they did to like kind of add that presence to it, and it's really tough to replace a talent like
Is Fink the guy who goes, "Let's get ready to rumble"? Is that that guy? Who are you talking about?
No, it's not, Lauren. But Fink talks like this. The other guy's Michael Buffer.
Is he later?
Michael Buffer, yeah. He's in WCW.
Sorry.
No worries.
This match was really good. It starts with like Razor taking off his necklaces and handing them to a hand.
Anything happens to this, something happens to you, Chico.
Yeah,
he said that before every match, and it was so good because he'd be like shit talking the guy at ringside. He'd be like, and then like pointing to the chains, pointing at you, and then pointing at him, and it's like pointing at you again. Just like the amount of shit he gave him. And then he threw the toothpick in the face, which like the fucking coolest.
Yeah.
Like, the height of disrespect. Shit.
And he was a good guy at the time.
I know. So I was going into this being like, oh, obviously like Razor Ramon is like the heel. But then watching the match, I was like, oh, like Martel is clearly the heel.
He starts doing the Bryan Danielson jumping jacks.
He does the jumping jacks. I love it. I love it. And he's like slapping Razor Ramon on the back of the head repeatedly, like really quickly as like a bitchy move.
Yeah.
Taunt. But yeah, so like it starts off with like, I guess Martel is kind of like out wrestling Razor, and like commentary selling it as Razor Ramon is more of like a brawler and Rick Martel is more of like a out and out wrestler. But then Razor starts hitting him with like really cool power moves because he's so ginormous, and just like lifting him up and around and just tossing him around. He does his favorite like barrel roll thing.
Yeah, the fallaway slam.
Yeah.
It's actually called the sack of shit.
Yeah.
And then he starts slapping Martel's head as a fuck you.
I do. It's fun. This is like such an epitome of like 90s wrestling, because like everything that you're talking about is accurate and there is a story to this, but there's like 5 moves in the first 10 minutes of this match. Like it's like a lot of strikes, a lot of like kind of arm twists,
That's because
it's wrestling.
Yeah, I really want to hear what you two think about this, because I I thoroughly enjoyed this match. Like, I thought...
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Yeah, I liked this match.
I did, too, and I liked it specifically because they were presenting the wrestling. I'm making big quotation marks here.
She is. She is. I can imagine.
That's presented as a heel thing, mm-hmm. and it's something that I have a lot of issues with in more modern wrestling, where I see Zack Sabre Jr. or other people doing this, and it's harder for me to I have such a short attention span and I don't know enough about wrestling, so for me my attention just wanders when I'm seeing really intense floor work or whatever, or like submission moves. I'm just kind of like I just want to see the big fucking power moves or jumps or whatever. I'm a stupid modern wrestling fan in that way. That's just what I like. I like the showy big moves. I like the spectacle. So, but I think it worked for me in this match with Razor Ramon and Rick Martel, because Martel was kind of presented as, like, it's Healy that he's doing that. It's Healy that he's doing all of these holds and stuff. And, like, and then it doesn't last for that long. Like, my attention doesn't have a chance to wander before Razor starts, like, fucking just tossing him around and stuff. Yeah. Like, I don't know. For me, it worked really well. And it has one of the coolest things I've ever seen in a wrestling match, that I've never seen before, which is where Martel has Razor Ramon in like a Boston Crab hold, and Razor powers out of it by just like powering his legs down, and with the momentum of that, he fucking flips Martel's entire body around into a pin, and then he fucking pins him, and it's Martel kicks out, but he fully flips his whole goddamn body over into a pin, and I was like, oh! His legs are so powerful, like I've never seen that before. It was so cool.
Yeah. It builds to, like, when it starts getting to those like pinning combinations and stuff, like I feel like this match builds to the sort of like false finishes, if you will, really well.
Yeah.
It works the crowd up. Everybody gets really into it. And it helps that it's like, this is an era where the refs are counting like 1, 2, 3. Like they're so fast. And there is a believability that like any pin, no matter if it's like a small package or if it's hit after a finisher, there's like believably could end the match. It's not like somebody goes for like what you were just talking about, where they do sort of like the counter pin and then the ref goes for a super slow count and you know that it's going to get countered into a different pin or it's going to get kicked out of. It was like there was an urgency to this that I really liked. I thought the finish of the match, if we can jump there, was crazy, because Razor hits the Razor's Edge, which is one of the all-time great finishers,
the Jesus Throw,
undisputed,
and it kind of looks, to me, it kind of looks like Rick Martel sandbags him a little bit. Like, it looks like there's a little bit of an effort for Razor to get him up. And Razor is 6'7" and, like, built like a fucking jackhammer, so he doesn't care. And he just, like, pulls up Rick Martel and then looks like he hits it. Like, this is a really stiff-looking Razor's Edge, right?
It's really stiff.
He spikes him right on the neck.
I want to say, because it was the storytelling throughout the match, that Rick Martel was working on his lower back, setting up for the Boston Crab, so, you know, maybe he was having a little difficulty, but it didn't truly look like that in the moment, so...
Yeah.
It was way more of a upper neck head.
Yeah. Attack. Yeah, it was a super stiff-ski looking there. On Martel.
And then the ref hits like the slowest count of all time comparatively to what he was doing earlier.
Totally.
And it really puts it makes, I think that's a thing that they do pacing wise really well in some of these older matches, where that like that last final pin, they do just a little bit slower than all of the other counts. And it does make it feel like it builds to more of that like climax of the match finishing.
Yeah. Yeah.
I appreciate that.
I'm gonna give this one a little bit of a generous score, just because, you know, I had a soft spot in my heart for it, just for the storytelling. I'm gonna give it 3.5 toothpicks. I know it's a little high, but you know, I was feeling in a mood after watching that.
Oh yeah.
I really enjoyed it, man. Yeah. There were like moments that I was like, yeah, like I said, blown away.
Yeah. We're going to jump over a couple of years, a whole different promotion. We're going 1996, WCW, Bash at the Beach. You might have heard of it. This is a spicy one. This is one that it's, again, this is a thing. I've heard about this so many times. Like, undebatably one of the most important moments in professional wrestling history. I've never actually watched this before, you know? And so it was like this was awesome to go back and revisit and actually watch and sort of see. So we're talking about the Outsiders versus Team WCW, which is Randy Savage, Lex Luger, Sting, in the hostile takeover match. In lieu of a video package, you have what's his name? Michael Buffer sort of just like running down like, this is the stipulation of the match. And I thought he did a great job, and it did lend a lot of gravity to it, you know?
It was interesting, like, listening to him talk. It's like, the heroes of WCW.
Yeah.
The defenders of the company. And it's like, he's talking about the, like, I guess the Outsiders at this point. There was supposed to be three of these interlopers, but appears there is now only two. He's talking so, like, disparagingly about them as they're coming down to the ring. It's wild. It's so funny.
My favorite,
because he's a company man, right?
Yeah.
And they're against the company.
My favorite thing about the setup to this match, though, is that it's like, he's like, if the Outsiders win, WCW as we know it will be finished. It's not like a billionaire like invasion angle or anything. It's like, it's just two dudes named Scott and Kevin who are like kind of assholes.
Yeah.
And it's like if they win, this entire company owned by Ted Turner is going to crumble. And I was like, no, those are just two fucking dickheads.
That was unclear to me. Like, the stakes were unclear because he was building it up so much. I was like, is there something on the line?
I think,
like, similar to how, like, is it happening in Impact right
the
now?
The Honor No More.
Honor No More, where they actually have, like a stake in, like, if they win, they get to, like, you know, have a say over matches and shit, right? But, like, this was just kind of like, what are the actual stakes? Or is it just like they're dicks and they'll be infiltrating? Because
it's about the honor and the integrity of Lex Luger.
Lex Loser was a sign that I saw, which was pretty funny.
Yeah, hell yeah. That was me. I was holding that sign.
Were you even born when this match happened?
I was.
We were three. Okay?
I was three and this many months. Okay.
So, the idea was when Scott Hall came over initially, he came out of the crowd and, like, you know, it was this big deal. It's like, he doesn't work here. You know, it's like, he was an outsider, right? Like, he, and they were alluding to, you know, allegedly, this is a guy from WWF that is coming over with no grounds or means to be here, right? So this was an actual invasion that was going on, but they never said specifically what was going on, right? So they're like, This is not supposed to be happening. And then when Kevin Nash came, and then kind of like all of, like, they were alluding to the whole time that this was a WWF invasion, and so the weight of this was WCW at its very core is being attacked by these outsiders from a different company, and the threat of that other company running amok or taking over or whatever it is. And they had this third person that they alluded to that, you know, was going to be the final nail in the coffin for WCW. And they come out, it's just the two of them, you know, it's like, you know, where's the other guy? Mean Gene comes to the ring and it's like, hey, let me ask you something. You told me there was going to be three of you. It's like, don't worry, Scheme Gene, you know, the third guy will be, he's here. Don't worry about it. Right.
Yeah. They're both like, we will be able to handle it for now. But rest assured, our third guy is in the building.
Josh, at the time, did anyone think that the third member of the Outsiders would be Emilio Estevez or Rob Lowe?
What?
Or Patrick Swayze? Mm-hmm. Any of the other the cast of the film The Outsiders.
This is a terrible joke.
Yeah, you know, that was a real consideration between me and my my dad, who were watching on an illegal cable box at the time. We were having that discussion when I was, I don't know how old, like 14.
Yeah. And he said, "Stay golden, pony boy." And
yeah.
Okay.
God damn it, Campbell.
Okay.
Oh, I do also really like that. Sorry, the last thing that I want to say before we get into the match itself is when they're waiting to find out who the third man is. Somebody on commentary says this is just like waiting on the verdict in the OJ case.
Yeah, which is like
is insane.
Like, can you ever like timestamp yourself more than like?
Yeah.
Oh my god. Like,
this couldn't possibly be any more 1996.
Like the only thing that could have been worse is like a Monica Lewinsky joke in there, like just something yeah. horrible to like timestamp. It's like just facepalm. It's like you could have said anything else.
Yeah. Like yeah, like some Kevin Nash goes for like a splash in the corner and somebody makes a Rodney King reference like that.
Oh jeez, let's not go there. Yeah.
I'm glad they didn't. We can stick with OJ.
Yeah.
I did also like when he's doing the when he says Scheme Gene, he hits a mang there. And it's like he's still doing the accent, you know? Like it's like
he's so funny with it. It's like, where is the Nacho Man? Hey, where's Scheme Gene? Where's Billionaire Ted? You know, yeah. He's so funny at doing that.
He's great. He does the toothpick flick. They sort of kick off with it's interesting because it like starts off as like a handicap match, but they're still clearly the heels, right? Like, yeah. And they never commentary is very smart never to refer to this as like a handicap match, because that kind of. We're conditioned to sort of sympathize with the people who have the handicap on them, right? But it's a really interesting dynamic of like how much everybody hates them, how much they're still kind of like cheating and weaseling their way around. I know Lauren wants to talk about Kevin Nash's pants.
Yeah, I can do that now. I was going to save it for a later segment.
Oh, okay. We can save it.
Sure. Whenever you're feeling right about yourself, whenever you're... you just do your...
All of Sting, Randy Savage, and Lex Luger all come out in Sting face paint.
Yeah.
And I did have a little story to tell here. I did a little bit of research when we were preparing for this episode, and I did not check to see who wrote this article, but it was somebody who was involved in wrestling, like a wrestling journalist at the time or something. I don't think it was enemy of the pod, Dave Meltzer, because it wasn't on his website, but there was a wrestling journalist whose article I was reading where he was doing a retrospective on Razor Ramon. And one of the stories that he had was of him meeting Scott Hall in a bathroom. I think it was at DDP Yoga to do an interview with him. And he was like saying like he needed a break because it was actually like really hard. So he went to the bathroom so he wouldn't get too sweaty before his interview. Scott Hall was in the bathroom and Scott Hall was like just started talking to him like he was a regular person, and he was saying, "I have an interview coming up," and the guy was like, "Yeah, that's with me." And Scott Hall was trying to like tell him about his son or whatever, but one of the stories that Scott Hall told him was that he was like, "You know, I actually gave Sting the idea to become the Crow."
Ooh.
And he apparently was like, Sting was starting to like, he wasn't bleaching his hair anymore, like he was going for dark hair, and he was like, "Are you still gonna wear your bright ass clothes?" And Sting was like, "Yeah," and he was like, "Man, have you ever seen The Crow?" And he was just like, explained the whole crow gimmick with like the cool long cone and like the baseball bat, and he was like, I'm not saying you should rip off the Undertaker, but you should just rip off the Undertaker.
That's awesome. There was another story that how he came up with the razor gimmick. Apparently Vince had like never seen Scarface, and like
him, yeah,
like,
yeah,
yeah, oh my like, God. Like him and Mr. Perfect went in, and they it's like he just started doing Scarface, essentially. Just start, and Vince was like, ha 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 ha, that's great, pal. But yeah,
that's sick.
Sting also in this match looks fucking sick. Surfer Sting is better than Crow Sting. I think they should do some weird, I don't know, do some kind of thing in AEW, some Danhausen magic or something, where Sting becomes like Surfer Sting again, because that would be great.
Cowabunga.
So we kick off with 3-on-2. Lex Luger sort of like starts out. He gets taken into the corner. Sting hits a splash on Kevin Nash while Kevin Nash is holding Luger in the corner, and it like knocks Lex Luger out. They throw Lex Luger on the board. Right, they do this very convincingly.
Yeah, man, like they fully have like a full medic crew come out holding his like spine and spinal column straight and shit. Like I was like, I knew it was a work, but I was still like, they're selling this beautifully.
They
like,
sell it beautifully, except for when Scott Hall comes over and kicks him 3 times and then walks away, and nobody freaks. Everybody is just totally okay with it.
Like, the medic crew was just like, anyway, we gotta get him out of here.
We get, and then it kind of devolves into a normal like tag match, right, where you have like Savage and Sting versus the Outsiders, and it's for what it's worth, I think it runs maybe a little bit long, but I think it's a pretty good tag match.
It's all right. Like I think it, you know, it's a little sloppy at some points, and like I think, you know, I think the problem with Scott and Kevin is they relied on the same old moveset too much, right? Because you had all the usual suspects, and it's a little easy to put on the nose if you watch back-to-back-to-back matches with Scott Hall, and like you're kind of watching through all of them. But like you know all the moves, right? And you know all the moves for both the guys, and so they're kind of like going through the motions. Like, and it's still like, you know, they're still like really good at their side of it. You know, just kind of like, you know, the selling, and just kind of like, you know, making the other team look good, and like, you know, it's all well done. It's just, you know, I think there was a like a little confusion back and forth, and I love Macho's intensity in that match too.
Macho Man botches the fuck out of dodging an elbow drop.
Oh like, my God. Terrible.
And he gets hit so much worse than if he had just stayed still. I think it's a thing where it's like my issue with this match, I think what it boils down to is like the face team doesn't sell like the stakes that Michael Buffer set up of like the integrity of the core of WCW is at stake. And the face team doesn't go for a pin in this match for the first like 18 minutes. There's no like real like attempt for them to win. Whereas I do think that like the Outsiders do a great job of being braggadocious assholes. And like they do a great job. Like there's a 2.5 minute spot where the only thing that's happening is they're cheating while doing an abdominal stretch in the corner, and it's the best spot in the entire match. It rules. Like they're using each other to like pull, and then they tag out, and Kevin Nash comes in. And you're like, oh, something crazy about to happen, and then they just do the same spot again with the guys switched. It's perfect. It's so good.
And Randy Anderson, and I'll talk about him again. Again, he's the biggest idiot of all referees I've ever seen in my life. He's so stupid. And it's just like, I remember watching the match, and I was just like, I was laughing. I was like, you know, like they're cheating and distracting. And like Scott Hall would just point over to the Macho Man and be like, look at him over in the corner. And then like Randy Anderson would like walk over there and talk to him for 2 minutes, and like Macho is yelling, it's like, he's cheating right there. And like Randy Anderson is like pointing and talking to him, and that's all Scott was doing. He's like, look at Macho Man.
yeah
hey, you look at this prick over here.
So the team WCW starting to get the upper hand, and then Hulk Hogan comes out. How do we feel about Bobby the Brain Heenan's? Whose side is he on?
Well, I think he had to do it. He had to sell the confusion and like the moment of, oh my god.
You don't think it kneecaps the surprise a little bit?
Absolutely not. That's part of the surprise. It's chaos.
Like, I get it. Right? Like, I get that's not what they wanted. They wanted to really pump that, you know, Hogan was coming out to sell the good guys. The thing is, Bobby the Brain Heenan has been against Hogan for the last decade or whatever, right? And every time Hogan comes out, he never trusts Hogan. He thinks Hogan's a rat. You know, he's always calling him out. So that narrative was always there. So, you know, him asking whose side is he on, is that more of that mistrust for Heenan? And I get in retrospect, you can look back and be like, what a stupid thing to say in that moment to like kind of ruin the suspense. But at the time, it was fine.
See, like I'm kind of just bringing this up as a point of conversation because that is the one other thing that I know about this match is that people smart against Heenan saying whose side is he on. And I was expecting to really hate it in the moment, but when I was watching it, I was like, if you watch the entire match, commentary the whole time is talking about, well, they said there's a third guy in the building. Who could it be? You know, and Heenan's being a fucking dickhead and he's like, is it you, Shivani? Are you the third man? You know, like Heenan's pointing everybody out, right? And it's completely, I understand the concept of like it kneecaps the surprise, but it also completely fits in with what Heenan was doing for the entire match.
Totally, right?
I don't see how that kneecaps the surprise at all. I've never heard this critique of this moment. So like for me watching it, with very little, you know, historical context for the moment, I didn't even notice it at all as being a thing, except for I kind of laughed when he said, whose side is he on? I remember I kind of went like, huh, like, obviously he's on the bad guy's side. He's the third man. Like, he's the missing third man. It's obvious. But, like, that's my smarky brain talking. As, like, a mark in the moment, you're just like, you should be in the high of emotion of being like, oh my God, it's Hulk Hogan.
Yeah.
And it's chaos. And this was something I never imagined possible. So like, that's the high of emotion that he is playing off of right there is like, what's he doing here? I have no idea. He could be here for any fucking reason. And it's like, That he's just, to me, he's not ruining the surprise. He is adding to it or like trying to prolong the surprise of the moment.
And let me tell you, like, you know, being a 13-year-old, like I grew up, like one of my first memories is of Hulk Hogan, right? Like I was a Hulkamaniac as a kid, you know, huge Hulk Hogan poster on my wall. Like say your prayers, eat your vitamins, do your homework, all that bullshit, right?
Drink your milk.
Yeah, all of it. I bought it in hook, line, and sinker. And then obviously around that age, like, I was still into Hogan, but like, you know, like, but he's a perennial good guy. Like, Hogan will never be a bad guy. So Bobby Heenan could have said, I just got it in my headset that Hulk Hogan is the third guy. I'd be like, no, he's not. what are you talking about?
And, the fuck out of here, huh?
The fuck out of here. And so when he did it, just a little context, Hulk Hogan comes out. He's walking around, you know, the referee is like, Hall and Nash are on the outside, you know, Macho Man's lying down. Hogan pushes the ref, gives Savage the old leg drop in the most mind-blowing moment where Hogan turns into a bad guy. And I was like, what the fuck is going on? I was like, Pops, explain to me what the fuck is going on. But it was wild. Yeah, it was crazy to watch.
And clearly the crowd also felt like, what the fuck? Because they start throwing trash into the ring.
So, well, before we get to the throwing trash, because we know that the post-match does not count towards the sanctity, the integrity of the heart of the toothpick rating system.
Yeah, not the bald head rating system, just toothpicks.
That's technically still a part of the match.
Well, so once, like, Hogan hits, no, Hogan hitting the leg drop is part of the match, but I'm saying the crowd throwing the trash, the promo that they cut afterwards is not a part of the match.
Oh, no,
so
absolutely not.
I want to get this toothpick rating before we get to the promo.
Yeah, so I gave it 3.25 toothpicks.
Okay.
I thought it was, again, some hits, some misses, you know, but I thought it was a little bit better than average.
Sure. So Hogan cuts a promo, Mean Gene's doing some like, why Hulk Hogan, why? And,
it's like, you, sir, I've worked with you for years, years. And you know,
Hogan keeps grabbing his arm and moving it higher.
I love that shit where he's like such a giant man. It works so well. Cause it's like a realistic thing that he would need to move his arm up, but it's also just such a heel move to be like, bitch, fucking move the microphone up to my face.
Yeah.
I love that shit.
And Hogan's doing the most like insane flexing the whole time. Like it looks like he's about to fall over.
This is a thing where I'm like, I'm not super well versed in historic wrestling, like older wrestling before my time. And watching Hogan doing this promo, I was like just enamored with like how much of himself he was putting into this. I was like, I remember pointing out to you, Campbell, I was like, look at his fucking fingers while he is talking. He is screaming so hard that he's just like flexing his fingers in weird ways because he's screaming so much that his whole body is like tensing in these weird ways. And then he's later, like, I noticed that his legs were shaking. Like he's this
shaking right out of
muscular
his cowboy boots.
Man, and his legs are trembling with the amount that he is screaming into this microphone. It's so wild to watch.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Hogan was one of the best promos of all time. Like, honestly, like, you know, like, it's like one time, like, he was talking about his biceps and, like, talking about, like, you know, this is George Bush, you know, and he's, this is the river that he's going to go across. And, like, and he's talking about it. And he's talking about his biceps and the war. And, like, and I was like, I'm a kid in Canada. I have no fucking idea what he's talking about. I'm like, man, that's so cool. That's the coolest shit he could be talking about right now. And I don't know, like, Hogan just gets into it and, like, he can just ramble about nothing. And, I just like listening back to this.
No.
He kind of talked in circles and stuff. But I remember at the time just being hypnotized, right? I was like, I don't know if it's the moment. I don't know if it's whatever it is. But Hogan just has this, like, he has this promo ability to just, like, draw you in, right? So...
And they're like, they're fucking high fiving and like.
Yeah. Mean Gene is like pointing at the trash in the ring. He's like, you know, this is going to be your future if you hang out with the likes of these two.
Yeah. Like, yeah. Yeah.
Let me tell you something, Gene. All this trash in this ring represents these fans out here.
It's amazing. It's a great promo, and it is like you can watch it now and you do get the feeling that this is a momentous shift. This is a watershed moment in 90s professional wrestling that like everything that has come since you can really trace back to like this moment. And it is maybe not quite as impactful as the Montreal Screwjob, but I think it is a more like impressive moment than the Montreal Screwjob.
I would argue that, man.
Really?
I would put this pretty much 1A, 1B, like...
Sure, yeah, like, yeah.
But, like, it's... I think this is maybe more, like, honestly. The NWO is, like... Because I know the Montreal Screwjob started the Mr. McMahon stuff, but
yeah,
they already had Austin going pretty hot. You know, I don't know if they would have got there with the Mr. McMahon. It's tough to say, man. Like, it's...
Totally.
But, like, I think both of these are, like, the two catalysts, right?
Oh, man, two things can be good. You know, I'm fully into two things being really good,
but not quite as impactful. I don't know about that. You know,
I think to me it's the way that the Montreal Screwjob has always been talked about to me. Again, as somebody who wasn't watching, is that like the Montreal Screwjob was the definitive moment where like kayfabe broke, like for real, and you started to blend into this like reality non-reality. Which is kind of the way that all wrestling has to be watched now, you know? Oh, I know it's fake, but that spot looked a little stiff. oh, I know, you know, like there's this, but maybe is it backstage heat? And it's the, you can trace like kind of all of the modern elements of like professional wrestling back to that like kayfabe breaking moment of the Montreal Screwjob, which for me puts it just a little bit higher. And I also think that it's because it's also because ultimately WWF won the Monday Night Wars, that the Montreal Screwjob leading to the Attitude Era definitively to me has to be more important than the formation of the NWO.
I would say the Montreal Screwjob doesn't happen unless formation of the NWO happens.
Okay.
There's no like, way they like, could be bringing in all
Bret Hart stars. Doesn't go to...
It doesn't happen. Like, it just okay. doesn't happen, right? So,
yeah.
I don't know. I would say, you know, we're just kind of arguing semantics and hypotheticals, but I don't know. I think it's 1A, 1B. I think they're just the same.
That's cool.
So we usually like to go chronologically here, but I want to jump out of order real quick, just because I want to sandwich this between our two NWO matches. But I really quickly want to talk about the NWO entrance to Monday Nitro with Dennis Rodman coming out of the limo. Because it's one of the coolest entrances of all time. They're just like, Jimi Hendrix is playing. They get out of this fucking huge limo, all smoking cigars, with Dennis Rodman in, like, Dennis Rodman just won the NBA championship and went to North Korea and is dating Pamela Anderson.
Okay. Like, I was literally about to ask you.
I think he was dating, what's her name? Carmen Electra right now.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That man had the most insane 1997 of all time. But it's like, this is a thing that I think just like speaks to how like, you know, to use a current term, how needle moving the NWO was. And how, like, it's, because I don't think it's just a thing of like how big wrestling at the time was. I do think that it's like this thing that like, and Scott Hall is very much in the background of this whole entrance, but it's something that like undoubtedly he had a hand in creating, was this original member of, and like how big this got and how paradigm shifting it was, you know. It rocks.
It rules. Like, yeah, like Hogan coming out to Voodoo Child is so iconic, and like the fact that they got that, like every time Voodoo Child hit, playing the belt guitar coming down to the ring, here he's smoking cigars, you know, like they're just like, the NWO at the time was like the coolest thing, and you saw it by all the NWO shirts in the crowd. They were so over, like they were rock stars, right? And of course, yeah, like Dennis Rodman wanted to roll with them. I think Dennis Rodman, like, you know, 2-3 weeks before this, was out partying with Bischoff and Hogan and all these people, and he missed practice for like game 5 or something like that. And they're in the finals. They're in the NBA finals. And like Rodman misses practice, and like, you know, it's like he's just like living this rock star lifestyle, and he's hanging out with wrestling dudes publicly. And it goes to show you, like, kind of like in the culture at that time, NWO made it kind of cool to watch wrestling. And then, like, you know, the counter reaction to WWE, like, you know, them starting DX and starting to get a little bit more edgy as well, right? It really, this is like, this is where the spark was just like, the whole thing went up, right?
Yeah. Do you have any thoughts on this entrance?
No, I didn't know who Dennis Rodman was, but now I know.
He's the worm.
It's also, it's cool that it's cool that X-Pac was in both NWO and DX, right? Like, that's got to be a real kind of feather in the cap to be like a guy who got to be in both of those in their like pretty like in their original run. Was there anybody else who was in DX and the NWO?
Sure, Shawn Michaels was.
What?
Yeah, you don't remember Shawn Michaels was part of NWO. In WWF. Or WWE.
He was like,
yeah, he joined the NWO.
But like, not in their original run.
Yeah, not in their original run, but you know, you can also say that X-Pac wasn't a part of the original DX. You know, it was Rick Rude, it was China, it was, you know. So it's like, okay, you know, how granular do you want to get?
I feel like X-Pac was, X-Pac was closer to the original DX than Shawn Michaels was.
Which is totally fair, and I'm totally just being an asshole. I appreciate
that. I feel like if you got inducted to, I don't know exactly where the cutoff for the NWO was, but I'm saying, sure, like if you got inducted to the NWO after La Parca, it you know, maybe.
Like, now please, La Parca was part of the LWO. I think we all know that.
Our next match we have from 1997, Slamboree. We've got the NWO, the time comprised of Scott Hall, Kevin Nash, and Six, a.k.a. X-Pac, versus Ric Flair, Roddy Piper, and Kevin Green. So another sort of like NWO versus Team WCW. The whole NWO versus WCW is kind of just like a recurring theme throughout their entire, like, oeuvre as a group, right? Like, it's just kind of like these jerks versus whatever three baby faces we think we can cobble together to beat them, which speaks to, you know, how good the NWO are.
Yeah, and it was kind of sad at points, because it's like it got to a point where the NWO had so many members, right? So they had so many members, and as soon as that started playing, like, the crowd just went fucking banana. Like, they would lose their mind, and it didn't matter.
God,
it could be like
Perry Saturn, maybe.
Perry Saturn was never in the NWO, but
I'm just picking like a mid card WCW guy. I don't know,
but it could be Horace Hogan, right? Like, Horace Hogan's coming out, and he got a huge pop because the NWO music was playing, and that's all it took. And then no matter what, you know, Hugh Morris, whoever was in the ring, you know, would instantly be booed because they're going up against the cool group, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Kevin Green is just like a dude who plays for the Carolina Panthers. Like, he's just like a football player. Is he the original Gronk? Like,
I was thinking more of a Mojo, but they'd also gotten Mongo McMichael before that.
Right. Right? Yeah.
Right. So yeah. I don't know if he was the original Gronk, but yeah, he's definitely on that Mojo kind of scale here. And what did you hear his music?
I was going to say, nothing is funnier than the difference between like how cool the NWO's entrance music is and how fucking corny this like football march, like,
and they're singing and they're like, we play football in the arena, and it's like, it's so fucking corny. I was like, this corny ass motherfucker, but he had great energy, I guess.
No. I appreciate how full circle the like 1-2-3 kid to Six, kind of his you can mirror his career, and he's always kind of tangentially linked to Scott Hall. I appreciate that.
Yeah, I didn't notice that. The crowd is like super fucking hot for this match, especially for Flair.
Oh, dude, Flair is over as Rover. They're in Charlotte, right? Like,
yeah,
they're in his daughter.
No, his. Don't be gross. His hometown.
Charlotte.
North Carolina.
Flair.
Oh my God. Stone Cold Shots After Dark with Laura.
Yeah. I love that he's just like chopping everybody. Like, he's Ric Flair came to do what Ric Flair does.
He cannot be stopped.
Like, yeah. Like,
his
a runaway
chops
train.
Are completely like the kryptonite for everybody there. Like, everyone is like destroying everybody, but as soon as Flair gets in the ring and starts chopping people, it's like, oh, everything's fucking done. All momentum is ruined because Ric Flair has started chopping people. We have no defense for this. No defense for chops.
Yeah.
And that right hand, the right hand that he's throwing too. It's like that right hand, the chop, the right hand, the chop. And you saw Flair's so good in the ring. He's so good. Like, it was so, he's so over the top, but he's so like, and there's the weirdest ass taunts in this match too. Like, everybody's doing these weird taunts to each other, and like,
he does this kind of like weird like hip thrust like,
yeah,
thing on the ring apron at like Kevin Nash.
I mean, yeah, it's like almost a DX thing, but it's,
yeah,
it, I guess it's like the NWO like sexy thrust. I don't know.
And then Piper slapping his ass.
Yeah.
We got
Piper also does some thrusts at one point. It's really awkward.
Nash versus Green. I was actually kind of impressed by Green in this match, right?
Dude, like, okay, so when Green comes out, he looks like such a dumbo, but yeah, then when he starts wrestling, you're like, wow, this guy can really go. Like, yep, he has so much energy and he does some impressive moves.
Yeah.
What does he do?
Shoulder
I
tackle.
I called him football boy because that's what I think it's Scott Hall calls him football boy. He screams at him football boy before he attacks him. He does a great slam and then he does a great double clothesline. That's what I wrote.
He does the double clothesline to knock everybody out of the ring, and we get this like little, I love the DO, the not the DO, the NWO huddle. Where they all kind of, they're like, all right, what do we got to do? Like, you know, like,
how are we going to crush them?
And I'm so conditioned by modern wrestling that I was like, oh, somebody's going to do like a tope or like a moonsault or something into the three of them just hanging out on the outside. And then I realized it was fucking Piper, Flair, and Green. I was like, oh, nobody is doing any topes. Like, at
none
all
of that's happening. Absolutely not.
The stuff with Piper is really fun. He and Hall work together really well. I really liked their segment of this match. Was really great. Kind of like going after Piper's injured leg, and then Piper just fucking losing it and like going nuts and doing all his like Piper spots. But those two, Hall and Piper, I think were of the match as a whole, like, really held it down well. Sort of the best dancing partners there.
Yeah, I for sure agree with that. And like, you know, it was interesting to see Piper, because Piper looked good. I mean, like, he was getting a little long in the tooth at this point. And you know, like, I thought Piper did well. I thought Flair did well. I thought Green, just for a new guy, did well. I thought everybody in this match kind of did well, but I think it was a problem with odd pairings at times, where it was like there wasn't as good chemistry with some of the people kind of in there mixing it up. So that kind of took away from it a little bit. But I thought overall it was a pretty fun, pretty entertaining match.
Also, like, on the Hall Piper thing, it's like probably the top two best wrestlers to never win the heavyweight championship, right?
Yeah. Like, I'd say those two guys right there. And Perfect, I would say, is probably number three.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. No.
There's a ref bump that devolves into like absolute fucking chaos.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this match gets so overbooked and out of hand. It's fitting that Dusty Rhodes is on commentary.
Yeah.
And then the Team WCW does end up winning this. It's interesting that more of the matches that we talk about in this have Hall on the losing side than the winning side. And I think does, again, like, speaks to his legacy as like a very giving performer and a guy who really understood, in a way that like Hogan never understood, storytelling, elevating him more than just like looking strong elevates him, you know?
That's cool.
Yeah, like, and I just want to point out as well that Randy Anderson, again, the referee for this match, was fucking insufferable. Just the worst referee in the entire world. He's like, he's totally blind to stuff. Like, they're blatantly cheating and doing, and he's like, he's looking up at the sky. Like, he's looking, like, he doesn't know. And, like, I don't know what he's doing this match. You know, fans, go out there, rewatch this match. Tell me if you agree with me. But it's it was infuriating. Infuriating match.
How many
toothpicks?
I gave it 3 1/3 toothpicks. I thought it was a pretty fun match.
Just as good as Bash at the Beach.
No, Bat.
Oh, Bash no, slightly Beach. Better. Slightly better.
Slightly better than that match.
Yeah, I'd agree. I'd agree. I think this was a slight improvement on the Bash at the Beach. Sorry, Lauren, you were saying, how do we feel? Okay. We got our last match of the evening that we're talking about. It may be kind of a weird pick, but I thought this was interesting. I wanted to bookend this. There's a poetry to sort of the first match and the last match here tonight. But we're going to 2001 to New Japan Professional Wrestling. We have Scott Hall versus Japanese Young Boy.
Now, I don't recognize this guy. I don't know who this is. Who is this? Maybe you guys can educate me.
He is almost unrecognizable at this time because he doesn't have like 3 feet of extensions on his head. Yeah.
He doesn't have like braids and a ponytail. He's not playing wicked air guitar. He's not yet the ace of New Japan. But you can tell here there is something like about him, right? Like he kind of carries himself in a way. There is a charisma.
There's a fire. You could tell he's got a fire.
A fire inside, like a young CM Punk. But this is it's Scott Hall versus Hiroshi Tanahashi, a very young Hiroshi Tanahashi. What's the I don't understand the timeline of this at all, where like you have the whole NWO being the hottest act in WCW, and then when WCW was acquired by WWF in 2001, did Scott Hall not go to WWF right away? He just like bailed and went to Japan for like a year. Because by 2002, and like by early 2002, he's back in the Fed wrestling Stone Cold at WrestleMania. So he had like, what, a 4-month stint in Japan where he wrestled Tanahashi and the Great Muta?
It seems like he did a short tour around multiple places at that time, but it was short.
Yeah, so what happened was, you know, when the buyout happened, not all of the big wrestlers went over, like Goldberg, Hogan, Scott Hall, Kevin Nash. Not all of them went over. So, like, a lot of them were just kind of sitting at home collecting paychecks. And Scott Hall was kind of out there on the indies. I think, I could be wrong, this was around the ECW time. The ECW debut could have been a little bit earlier. I'm not sure of the exact timeline, but yeah, I think he nailed it where I think it was, you know, about 5 months later, he was over in the Fed with the NWO, right? So, there's a lot of wrestlers that kind of like opted out and be like, no, I'm just going to sit at home and collect paychecks.
That rocks.
Pick up some extra money where I can.
Go on vacation to Japan. So this is like, he comes out to the Fugees.
It's so cool.
As if he couldn't get any cooler.
Yeah.
He does he spits the toothpick into Tanahashi's face. And then, you know, this is maybe a 5-6 minute match. But, I feel like the thing that stood out to me the most in this match was that, like, Hall works the Japanese style so well for a guy who like spent so long, like really, really deep in that. Like we talked earlier about the Rick Martel match as being like exactly what I think of when I think of like 90s WWF, like kind of 5 moves, not a whole lot going on. And then he comes over here and it's like, it's not like he's doing fucking, you know, like corkscrew moonsaults and shit. But he is
super, super strong style even.
But he works to Tanahashi's style. Like he doesn't force Tanahashi to work to his style. And I think it really works for this match. It's a really, really fun, quick little match to watch, right?
Yeah, like I don't know. Like I kind of watching Scott Hall in this match, I don't know. Like I felt he was a little sluggish, maybe. Like I didn't feel like it was the best Scott Hall, like Yeah, there was something about it that seemed kind of off. I don't know. Maybe I was looking at something else. Like, I don't know. Like, what? So you two thought it was pretty good, or
to me, that's part of the Japanese style.
Fair enough.
Is being a little sluggish and sort of selling stuff a little harder than you normally would in regular American wrestling.
Well, it's like that kind of, he's like, they're feeling each other out. They're kind of...
And he's like selling more with his face even. He's doing, like, even just the way he's talking or emoting, he's going like...
And it, like, there's a couple of kind of like heel things that he does that I think of as like I haven't things that he does in this match that I didn't see him do in any of the other ones, where he throws on like a wrist lock or maybe like a chin lock and starts like kind of like slapping around the face of Tanahashi,
mm-hmm.
right? And doing that, those things that I associate with like a Minoru Suzuki,
absolutely
things that I associate with like a very specifically like a Japanese heel kind of move set. And he lets Tanahashi get some shit in. He lets Tanahashi look good. I like, they throw a couple of references to, like, he does the abdominal stretch where he picks the heel, and it does kind of seem like they're doing sort of throwbacks to the Lightning Kid match.
Well, I mean, Scott Hall had like kind of like a few moves, and like, so he'd always do like the second rope, you know, back slam off the top. He did like the abdominal stretch. He did like, you know, that kind of like head slapping thing is that was a throwback. He used to do that all the time in WWF. But like, yeah, he did like the STF headlock thing, and like he slowed it down a little bit, and it was good. And he did a good job of getting Tanahashi over in this match. Like, he's always good at like really emphasizing his, like, if he's going to get somebody over, he's going to get somebody over. Right. Like,
oh yeah,
he's so good at that. And, yeah, he picks up the mic at one point, and who does he call it?
So he hits the razor's edge, and instead of going for the pin, he grabs the mic, and he calls out Keiji Muto.
That's right.
And he says, like, if you want to step in the ring with me, this is what's going to happen to you. And then he gets rolled up, and Tanahashi gets the win, and it's the crowd fucking loses it. It's great. It's so good.
It's awesome.
Him over huge.
Yeah, I thought it was a really fun, again, like kind of very similar to his 1-2-3 kid, just showing that this guy can work with anybody, isn't afraid to like put somebody over in service of a bigger story later, right? I'm sure like his match with Muta is fucking awesome, and it's like, yeah, sure, I'll lose to this guy on the way to that, because that's like, I'm not here for a long time, I don't need to be in like title contention, whatever, I just want to sort of like tell a couple of fun stories while I'm here. Kind of feels like the Scott Hall ethos, right? Of how it seems like he approached a lot of this. And it's a thing that I really, really respect historically when you compare him to his contemporaries and his, like, stablemates, like guys like Hogan, you know, who were always, always, always just about going into business for themselves. It's great to see a guy who was, like, very selfless in his art.
Yeah, you didn't see Scott Hall kicking out at three a lot, right? So... yeah, no, Scott Hall, again, like, one of the best guys as far as, like, and again, you could tell so much, like, him and Kurt Hennig were super close, and you can tell the way they worked, just blended so well, like, putting somebody over, selling for somebody, their facials, reactions, actually getting your opponent over, like, just all of that, just kind of his mentality and storytelling. Scott Hall is, like, yeah, one of the greatest of all time.
Yeah. How many, real quick before we kind of wrap up, how many toothpicks you give the Tanahashi match?
I gave it a 3 toothpick, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. I mean, like, we like to close things off with like a high spot and a botch spot of a little honorable mention of something that we really liked, something that we didn't care for quite so much about the matches that we watched. Lauren, you want to go first?
Yes. Okay, so real quick, my botch spot, we already mentioned it, it's during the Outsiders versus Randy Savage, Lex Luger, and Sting match of 96, that it's when it's like that awkward moment where Randy Savage spikes his own head off of, I think it's Kevin Nash at that point who's doing an elbow drop, and Randy Savage like sits up to avoid the elbow drop, but he ends up just getting hit in the fucking head with the elbow drop by sitting up.
Yep.
very awkward moment really stood out. That's my botch spot. And my high spot is also from the exact same match, but it's a costuming thing we alluded to earlier. So it's just the outsiders in general with their look. Well, I guess mine is Hulk Hogan, but Kevin Nash, Razor Ramon looks so sick. Okay, so Kevin has black tassels going down the sides of his red, like, leathery pants, and Razor Ramon is in his signature black little trunks with blood red blood dripping down, you know.
Blood red.
They
blood.
Just look. They look so sick. They look amazing. They're in contrasting, like, reverse colors, and it's just so cool.
Yeah.
That's it.
They look great.
Yeah.
Look great. $1 million.
Josh, I think I already know what your botch spot is.
You know? Randy fucking Anderson, man. Jesus Christ, that guy. I couldn't watch him anymore. I was like, I don't know what caught my attention. I think it was in the first match with him, and I just was like, what the fuck's this guy doing, man? And then in the next match, I was like, is that Randy fucking Anderson? And I couldn't stop watching him. I was like, what the fuck's this guy doing now? And my high spot is Scott Hall. I don't know how that wasn't your answer, Warren, even though this is a Scott Hall tribute episode. You know, I just...
Scott Hall. My high spot is
his trunks. His trunks.
No, I'm kidding. My high spot is the vignettes. So actually I went back and watched his first vignette, and then I got into a little bit of a rabbit hole of watching all of them.
Oh, amazing.
Aww.
So I would say, like, you know, anybody out there who hasn't seen them or hasn't seen them in a long time, go back and watch them. There's a lot of really fun ones, and it's just, again, so cool just kind of see him kind of, like, develop that character. And what a worker, what a cool dude.
Hell yeah.
Yeah,
the coolest.
My botch spot, of course, my botch spot is going to be Hulk Hogan. He's a racist idiot.
We all know this. We cover this.
But
I'm not virtual signaling here.
No. My specific botch spot about Hulk Hogan is that it's one of the most important moments in the history of professional wrestling. And he has all this time afforded to him to cut this promo. And fucks up the name of the group.
He's honestly giving it his all, okay? His legs are shaking.
He fucking says the wrong name of the group.
Twice.
Well, I guess you could call this...
The New World Organization. Brother.
Brother.
It's the Silver Dome all over again.
Yeah, man. I don't know. And he got it right the first time. He called it the New World
Order. He did.
And it's such a credit to, like, it would have been so much worse if he didn't get it right the first time. Because
they couldn't use anything. They couldn't use any of that footage, right?
Yeah.
Him saying, it would have to be, like, the next pay-per-view or the next Nitro when he said it, right?
No.
Or they would have just had to went with the New World Organization.
Yeah.
Right? What? That doesn't roll off the tongue.
Nope.
New World Org?
My high spot is Scott Hall, specifically from the exact same segment, where the entire time that Hogan is cutting this promo, Scott Hall is in the background doing all of Hogan's poses.
That's right.
He's doing the hand to the ear. He's flexing the biceps. He's hitting them with the weird, like, hand clasped flex. He's doing all of it, and he's just, like, soaking in the hatred, and he is being the baddest guy that he can be and, like, taunting them with Hulk Hogan's moves, and it's perfect. It's like as much, because the Hogan promo starts out great and then it gets kind of rambly and and it's at that point where you start noticing the Scott Hall stuff, and he kept me engaged and kept me in there and kept the heat on the entire time. And it's, again, you know, like in the entrance, he was kind of a background character, but the way that he was moving, you know, when they're with Dennis Rodman, is like he's always on, and he's always, like, sort of like pushing the narrative and pushing the story, and it's just a masterclass. It was so great to watch, you know.
Yeah, and there's a great GIF out there. I don't know if anybody could look it up, but it's Scott Hall in the ring with the NWO, and I think he's beside Bischoff and Hogan, and a fan throws a drink in the ring, and it pelts him right in the head, and the drink goes all over his head, and he doesn't flinch, like he doesn't blink, he doesn't flinch, he doesn't move his head at all. He just goes like this. He like moves his head, fixes his hair, and then keeps going. Like, it's the coolest. Like, I can't even explain how, like, I'd be like, you know, like, at least like some kind of movement. Did not flinch in the slightest. And then he just like just fixes his, like, he puts the drink into his hair. It's like the smoothest thing.
It's just more mousse.
More mousse.
We love Scott Hall.
You know? Scott Hall.
If you love Scott Hall, if there's other Scott Hall matches that we should check out, hit us up. Let me know. I want to watch a shitload of Scott Hall stuff this week. We're at facebook.com/stonecoldshots or Instagram, Twitter, Stone Cold Shots Pod, Stone Cold Shots Podcast. Hit me with your favorite Scott Hall matches, promos, vignettes. I hear the one at the restaurant is great.
Yeah, you can also drop those recommendations in the comments in your podcasting app of choice when you leave us a rating or a review. No problem with that, you know?
Usually I'd say give us those 5 bald heads all day, every day, but today...
But not
old
today.
Scott Hall, give us those 5 golden toothpicks, okay?
Hey.
Yeah.
Hey, for the bad guy.
Hey, yo.
We didn't even talk about bad times don't last, but bad guys do. Because that's the most stone cold cool shit I've ever heard anyone say.
Yeah, yeah. You referenced it in your heel promo at the beginning. Yeah. So, yeah.
It rocks. Scott Hall rocks.
Everyone knows it rocks.
Hard work pays off. Dreams come true.
Bad times don't last.
But bad guys
do.